stories. Stories are always good. And then I'll have, I have specific questions.
You need more light over there?
No, no. This is fine. I have specific questions about, like, when you traveled overseas, you guys pulling people over, which even made the New York Times, you know, that kind of stuff.
That would have got me in trouble big time if anybody knew it. Some of that stuff. You know, the, maybe I should give you some background. You're recording me now?
Yep, you're on.
First of all, one lonely old state cop isn't going to do much to save the governor and prevent assassination. That's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
Let's be realistic.
Yeah.
Towards the end of his term, he, I'm giving you kind of some background.
Mm-hmm.
Towards the end of his term, I agreed with the Secret Service to come do a survey, they call it, on his security, see what they thought. And in the end, they said, you got to have at least a 5 or 6 man detail, or don't do anything. Don't even be involved, because you're going to be in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, that's just not realistic, at least for us. And that kind of, that changed everything after his administration.
Right.
So then Goldsmith, for whatever you want to think of him, that was, that was kind of the evolution from there. And it was not the same.
Yeah.
I don't think my relationship with the governor was probably unique in all other governors, I guess. And because there was something similar with Hatfield. Was it Margie? What was his wife's name?
Antoinette.
That's right.
Antoinette.
They all had special relationships with their drivers.
Right.
That's really what they were.
Right.
Bob Burkine, Newell. And the same with Straub and McCall.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know any further back than that. Is what, and they all kind of had drivers. I don't think any of those people were nearly as involved as I was with Governor Attia.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond driving and security, which was practically nil, as I just said. But
right.
My relationship was more, I'm a facilitator. I'm pretty much, most of the time, I'm it.
Mm-hmm.
So if he needs a speech up in front of him on a podium, I usually put the speech up there.
Right.
That was one of my many duties.
Mm-hmm.
And most of this stuff, while I'm doing this, I'm even further away from being security.
Right.
Just ain't gonna happen.
Yeah.
But that's just the way it was. Now, when the governor started his term, he was assigned a state policeman, and he was, it, like many people, he, you see this time and time again, he had a problem with women. So there's some sexual harassment involved, and he was gone within 4 or 5 months.
Yeah.
So then the governor said, well, and all this time, Denny Miles and some of the rest of the staff were saying, you need to have somebody to help you. I mean, that's the way it is. And he's kind of a frugal, tight guy. And he,
yeah.
So finally he said, okay, why don't they just send us a few guys down and we'll alternate and we'll try out 3 or 4 guys and see if one of them really would work.
Mm-hmm.
So 3 of us actually did it quite a bit, and a couple other guys some, for about three or four months at the most. And then he decided, for whatever reason, probably because he liked the way I drove more than anything, he said, well, let's have Holbrook do the job. So I was working patrol at Salem Patrol Office at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was about a 7 or 8 year trooper. And pretty naive, and in fact, knew zero about politics and all that kind of stuff. I had no clue.
Yeah.
So you're throwing a babe into the whatever woods or whatever you want to call it. And I grew up a lot during his, especially first couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
not grew up in the sense of being mature, but knowing what that world is like.
Yeah.
And that kind of how things started rolling. And right away I was supposed to, the deal was, I was supposed to go sit in headquarters of state police. And when he needed a driver, I was supposed to come over, similar to what I had been doing for trying out.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to hand me the keys and go down and get in his car and go someplace.
Right.
Well, that's about as awkward as they come. That just doesn't work.
Yeah.
And the whole time his staff is saying, this is dumb, really dumb. But the governor's saying, I don't want to create a lot of problems and so mm-hmm. on and so forth. But I never did go into headquarters. I stayed right in the governor's office. When I took that job, there was a desk there. They had hired there were a special little detail of governor's guards. They didn't get mm-hmm. paid as much as a trooper,
mm-hmm.
but they sat in a guard shack at the house. They were mm-hmm. security mm-hmm. for the house.
Mm-hmm.
One of those guys was the day shift security in the Capitol building for the governor.
Mm-hmm.
So the theory was I wasn't really needed there, and I called bullshit on that from the get-go. And I assumed then I was in charge of all those guys and whatever else came down the pipe relating to the governor.
Right.
I assumed that role. Mostly, I took that upon myself, really.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm going to do this job, this is what I'm going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, we just kind of marched forward. In the end of that, I increased the security in the sense that I called troopers from patrol cars. I arranged for them ahead of time to be at the locations where we were going.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to
mm-hmm.
take a look at the place and secure parking spot and mm-hmm. that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And let us know if there's a problem going in.
Yeah.
Well, that's better than nothing, I guess.
Yeah.
And we did that.
Yeah, the governor tells a story about you guys going to Eugene, to Valley River Center.
Good example.
And walking right in the middle of an operation where you had to pause for a bit.
Yeah, and part of the problem with the governor and the staff really wasn't a problem, but it was maybe a good problem, but he had this affection for state troopers.
Mm-hmm.
Very much so, and you probably saw mm-hmm. that in talking to him. And that one of my many duties was to pry him away from some state cop that I had there and get him out there with the people he's supposed to be
right.
with, talking to,
yeah.
like the sponsors of the event, that kind of stuff, you know.
Right.
And he reluctantly would go do that, and he tolerated me because he knew, I guess, we never really discussed that, but I, not unlike Denny or Jerry, not unlike Lee Johnson,
mm-hmm.
he was a little different, but I was totally, I was into taking care of Governor Tia,
mm-hmm.
his everything. If he needs cigarettes, in earlier part of his administration, he smoked.
Mm-hmm.
I had cigarettes for him if he needed them,
mm-hmm.
if he needed anything.
Mm-hmm.
That was me. That's what I was, I just took care of him. And I didn't talk to him. I didn't start a conversation unless he initiated the darn thing. And
mm-hmm.
nobody told me that. I just figured out that's probably what you should do. You know,
yeah.
don't be bugging him with your BS. So, and the result of that, after, God, I don't know how we evolved, but things would happen. Sometimes the people at the event would be less than favorable towards him. They'd
mm-hmm.
be kind of antagonistic and stuff. And it really, it hurt him when that happened. I don't know how much, but you could tell it hurt him.
Yeah.
And he'd get in the car, and we'd start for home, usually, typically at the Benson Hotel in Portland. And,
mm-hmm.
and we'd jump in the car, and we're heading south, probably going too fast, too, because we're both tired
right.
and had enough of this stuff. And after a while, the governor he'd sit there and stew, and then he'd say to me, well, Lon, what do you think? And I said, well, they weren't very nice to you in there. And he said, yeah. Well, what do you think? And my pet phrase was, Governor, you know what I think. Fuck them and feed them dog food.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I usually say.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd sit there and chuckle, and it'd kind of bring you back to reality, I think. And that way, I think that really did help him, really, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't, I wasn't all that serious, and he knew I wasn't serious, but that kind of brought in perspective. You know, let's move on here. So that was kind of fun. One of the things I'm kind of rambling too, I guess, but one of the things I had to kind of break him of, if you will, is looking out the window and waving at people. Uh-huh. And he'd love to do that. Early on, anyway.
Yeah.
They'd spot him because he's got his face in the window. And we're going too fast.
Right.
Besides, it's not very good for security because just one car going down the road. Hmm. So I mentioned to the governor, I said, well, there's two things here. You're going to have to figure out if you're going to do that, you're going to have to lighten up your schedule so we're not going down the road too fast. Because we're getting too many calls and too much flack for you speeding down the road. And that's what happens. Mm-hmm. Reluctantly, he went along with that. He understood. He had to quit looking out the window like that and waving at people. Mm-hmm. So if people kind of thought they spotted him, I made it damn hard for them to really get a good look at him.
Right.
They're going to have to go pretty fast or do some pretty fancy maneuvering to really take a look at him because we're gone.
Yeah.
So that's usually kind of how that shook out. Early on, kind of relating to that, he liked this little black Buick Skylark. Mm-hmm. Thought that was really a cool car. Mm-hmm. The perception and just the whole persona, I don't know what you'd call it, but he liked that. But it wasn't a practical car. If you load Mrs. A and the governor and I in there with our luggage for 2 or 3 days, it damn near impossible. Mm-hmm. You almost needed a roof rack or something. Yeah. And he finally said, and I kind of worked on him for quite a while, I said, you know, I can get a Ford, any kind of Ford, including the Ford Lincoln, for a lot less money than you're paying for this little Skylark, mm-hmm. or the state's paying for it. Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah, but I just don't like the way it looks. Well, whatever. So we ended up with the new Mercury, finally. And we had that for like a week. And it was a big car, mm-hmm. one of those bigger Mercuries. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't black. It was like a green color.
Right.
And it got smashed going to the Portland or the Hillsborough airport to pick us up. It got smashed. That's another thing I'd arrange for state police to be shuttling stuff.
Right.
That was one of my main duties.
Yeah.
And that was the end of that brand new car. So he finally said, I said, Governor, we're gonna have to do a Ford here, like a Lincoln. That's the only thing really. Let's get serious. All right. So that started the Lincolns then. Mm-hmm. In fact, we were without a car because of that crash, and we were driving the superintendent's old car, the state police superintendent's mm-hmm. old car. In the interim, we had this Ford getting prepped back in Detroit, again, for about half the money that Skylark was costing, because that's a package Ford yeah. Motor Company had. So I jumped on a plane with another guy, and the two of us went back and got that car. I'm not real sure how smart that was either, because driving a new car out of the factory isn't really all that smart a thing to do, I don't think. Mm-hmm. But we did it anyway, and the car held together. Mm-hmm. And matter of fact, it's kind of a fun part of that story. There was a section of freeway at the time, and I think that was then 84, or now it's 80, and that section of freeway mm-hmm. that went across the nation. In Utah, they still had a wide open two-lane, kind of like a state highway. It really wasn't a freeway, but that was the last of non-freeway.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we had just passed a whole bunch of cars. We weren't fooling around. We were going home. And here comes a Utah State Patrolman at us with moving radar, sure as hell. Mm-hmm. And his eyes are getting pretty big. And we had just passed a whole bunch of cars. So that the guy that was with me, I happened to be driving at the time, He said, well, what do you think we should do? And I said, might as well just keep on trucking close to the state line anyway. And he said, oh, what the hell? Because it took that guy a long time to get turned around.
Right.
And by the time he got turned around, there's a lot of distance he couldn't make up. Mm-hmm. So we never saw anybody again. We got to the state line, we slowed down. Because you know sure as hell he's going to call down the line and say, look out for this Lincoln. And another fun thing I used to do, but out of necessity, I'd put the number one plates in the suitcase and when we go back to the governor's conference.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the stuff you've probably heard. And I'd put them on the Lincoln that I'd rent back in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And the average person would look at that plate and say, wow, Oregon shipped their car over here for this? This is something special. And all I did was put plates on a rental car. That's all I did. In fact, we tried to get into a parking lot at one of those fancy hotels in D.C. And they waved off the Department of the Secretary of the Interior. It was in one of those little Chrysler limos at the time.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't let him park there. But they looked at our plate and let us park in there. And the governor said, you know, that's pretty cool. That's all right.
Uh-huh.
And that, you know, people triple park in D.C.
Yeah.
And that helped, too, that plate.
Yeah.
But you really couldn't leave the car unattended, triple parked or wherever it was, because you got to keep an eye on that thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I didn't run those one plates. He wanted to start out, he wanted to put those on his car all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I convinced him, this is not a smart thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Do that on special occasions and parades and that kind of stuff. And don't do it just everyday traffic. Again, the same problems with him waving at the window.
Right.
Security and problems and complaints. Just stupid. So he said, well, what's my latitude here? What can I have? And I said, well, I think he came up with the idea of VGA 220.
Mm-hmm.
And that was February 20th.
Yeah.
What that was, his initials. So he thought that was kind of cool. And it was, at that time, it wasn't, the state of Oregon hadn't got to VGA 220.
Right.
So it's an odd plate.
Yeah.
But still, it didn't look that much out of place.
Right.
And then we just had a regular plate, just this random plate like anybody would get. So all three of those plates were good for, I had registrations from DMV saying, good for any car that the governor is in, mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept all those plates around, usually in the trunk of the car. Even sometimes I remember I didn't get them switched like I should. I'd have maybe not the one plate, but maybe two different plates on the car, mm-hmm. front and back.
Mm-hmm.
I even had a trooper tell me one time that's not legal. And I said, show me where that's not legal to have two different plates.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't find anything. It's legal.
Yeah.
In fact, at that time, it was Vanita Howard was the spokesperson for DMV.
Mm-hmm.
And she came up. She wanted to talk to me at the governor's office, and I went out and talked to her. She said, Lon, she said, we've made a decision at DMV, the commission, if I have it right, the DMV commission or whatever, highway department commission, they passed a policy, is it? I'm not sure what it's making a state rule anyway.
Yeah.
That legislators and these other people that have these fancy plates can only have one plate because some of these legislators are abusing their plate privileges and they're not renewing when they should. So you or the governor have to decide which plates you want to have because I know you got three or four plates. And I said, Benita, that's really doesn't make any sense. First of all, the state of Oregon is paying for all those plates. It doesn't change anything.
Mm-hmm.
She said, well, we've made the ruling. You got to do this. So she left. She's announced to me that's the way it's going to be. So I went in to talk to Jerry, told her what had just happened. So she said, okay, I'll take care of it. So she called, I think he's Harvey Mumau, was the director of DMV at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't there for the conversation. I didn't stick around for it. But I'm sure it went like, Harvey, how do you like your job? You know? And it wasn't long that Benita Howard was back up there. She said, well, what plates would you like to have? You know, that was the end of that.
Right.
Some people, and they get bureaucratic, they think they can pretty well call the shots. You know?
Yeah.
It's incredible sometimes.
Did you make a safety argument to her about that?
Oh, yeah. I told her what was going on,
yeah,
and all the reasons, and she didn't care. We mm-hmm. made the rule. This is the
yeah.
way it is.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't tell her, but you're going to have to make the rule another rule. You know, this ain't working.
Right.
And that was kind of how that went. I'm not sure what I should... I'm rambling on and jumping around, but...
No, you're doing great.
You wanted to talk about the Middle East.
Yeah, yeah. So, first question, the 1984, I want to hear about that trip. It's when you went to Saudi Arabia and Syria and that one.
Okay.
Did you also go with him when he went to Taiwan and then to Syria, his around-the-world trip?
I don't know that he ever went to Taiwan and Syria.
Yeah, he did. He did.
I did.
He was, Assad had asked him back after he'd already committed to Taiwan. There was an Arab-American legislators or something. Denny went on that.
I did not, no.
Okay, okay.
And actually, we kind of felt that out on the big trip we took. Mm-hmm. You know, how much value was I...
Right.
At those trips, you know, you kind of weigh that for the cost and everything. And, yeah, somebody's going to, well, for instance, in Syria, I think I had more people, more bodyguards than the governor did,
mm-hmm.
those Syrian guys.
Mm-hmm.
And I think more because they're watching me. They're not
yeah.
really cared about whether I got killed or not. And I don't know the real value of me being there, other than that, the governor, again, would have somebody to help him that was there.
Mm-hmm.
There were times, like, when you go into Egypt, for instance, they required us to, each of us to exchange a certain amount of European currency.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you had to, that's forced. When
right.
you go into the country, you got to do that. And then when you leave, they only allow you to turn back so much,
right.
a lesser amount. And I stayed up. Oh, 2 or 3 hours longer than anybody else did to try to get all that money turned back into the Egyptians. The money we could get out of
mm-hmm.
them. The rest of the people, everybody else slept. Denny and the governor and Mrs. A was in Egypt, I think. She met up with us later anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what I usually addressed her. I called her Mrs. A.
Mm-hmm.
And that was another thing. It comes to sitting in the car. He would, I'll go back to the Middle East
mm-hmm.
in a minute. He would insist almost always in sitting in the right front seat.
Mm-hmm.
And she would then be in the back seat.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes I felt kind of, she in a sense is really without a husband for 8 years.
Yeah.
And my wife, in a sense, was without a husband for 8 years too.
Because
mm-hmm. I wasn't home. My average work week was almost just short of 70 hours,
mm-hmm.
not counting the nights that I never came home.
Right.
Hotel, motel, you name it.
Yeah.
And she virtually raised our daughter for those 7+ years on her own because I wasn't there.
Yeah.
I was there part of the time, but not very often.
Yeah.
And that part I always regretted, but... My wife had the same respect for the governor that I did. She said, well, this is something that has to be done. We're going to do it. So that's kind of the attitude she took, too.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, back to the Middle East. Some of the things that may have happened there that were...
you go there, and you're first in Saudi Arabia.
Right.
And
I don't have a gun, either.
Yeah, exactly. You don't get a gun until Israel.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Did Denny tell you this or something?
Well, it comes up.
Okay.
I think the governor might have told me, too.
Well, that's the other thing. The governor was probably as interested as to what I was doing and what I was thinking as anything else.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because relating to that and everything else, the relationship I had with him was probably different than any other state cops around, any other governors, in that I had total freedom, and I respected and appreciated that. I could virtually walk into any meeting he was having. I could sit down or just walk in there or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and nobody would tell me I couldn't be there. Because
mm-hmm.
as far as he was concerned, I could do whatever I needed to do, whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
He would sometimes look around and wonder, is there a security problem, or mm-hmm. why is he here? But other than that, I mean, he didn't say, what do you want, or anything like mm-hmm. that. He just sometimes he'd wonder. And there are occasions when I'd kind of interested in what was going on in the meeting, and I just went in there and sat down.
Right.
That's fine. He had that freedom. And there was, to my knowledge, nobody really had secrets or held anything back from me.
Mm-hmm.
And I had full confidence of everybody, because they knew darn well that I was totally 100% Governor Attia and taking care of him.
Mm-hmm.
And I did, again, I wasn't a politician or anything else. I'm his facilitator, I guess, mm-hmm. if you will. Mm-hmm. And that special relationship was pretty special to me, I think.
Yeah.
Quite frankly. And I learned a lot about how things work and what goes on, and I learned, of course, a lot about him and how honest and how decent of a man he really was and how much he cared.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think most politicians aren't to that degree that he was.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure of that.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I had to really fight to not get upset when somebody's really razzing him about, you know. I remember Mark Hass, who's now a senator, I think. He was asking some pretty snooty questions at the time. He was working for one of the TV stations. And I kind of like to smash his nose for him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a thought in my mind, that's all, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, back to the Middle East. Mostly I just... the only, like you just said, the only gun I got was in Israel, and I got that from the Marines, mm-hmm. from the security detail at the embassy, and I had to take it back just before we left, but I'm not too sure. They gave me a 5-shot revolver or some damn thing. I'm not sure how much help that would be mm-hmm. either, but anyway, I had one
mm-hmm.
for whatever use it was, but you can't travel. Even in those days, you can't travel with a gun overseas.
Mm-hmm.
Now, stateside, at first I didn't fill out papers or have to do anything, but then early on, I had to submit a form when you checked in that I was armed.
Mm-hmm.
So then when I'd get on the plane, sometimes the pilot would call me up there into the cabin, and they'd tell me things like, you know, those bullets make big holes in my airplane. And I said, yes, sir, I know. I don't intend to discharge that in this airplane. I'm just packing it with me because I need it when we get to the airport.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I understand that, he says. They would usually say, a couple of captains took my gun away from me and kept it in the cabin.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'd ask them if I could get it back before, you know, in
yeah.
a timely fashion before we went down the gate.
Yeah.
And that wasn't a problem, so what the hell.
Yeah.
And, but back, I'm going to keep trying to get through the Middle East part of that, keep deviating from that. But we were pretty damn beat on that trip. And one of the funny things, we ended up in Cyprus.
Mm-hmm.
Which you had to do to get to Israel from Arab country. You got to get to a neutral place.
In fact, I don't know if you just saw, but President Trump was the first flight direct from Saudi Arabia to Israel.
I am not surprised. I believe that.
The very first time ever. So
that's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, the Israelis thought highly enough of him that they allowed that to happen.
Yeah.
It happened. I don't know if that could go the other way.
Uh-uh.
If they get into Saudi from Israel, I don't think they'd.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting relationship too, isn't it? Major terrorist financiers, also a major ally of the United States. You know, how do you deal with that? You know, that's goofy. Well, that's the way things are.
That's the way things are. That's why I teach the Middle East and I have a good time.
We were laying on the beach in Cyprus, and just exhausted. And I was laying on some kind of towel or blanket or something, and I looked up the governor, and he's looking around with his camera, looking through the viewfinder and stuff. What the hell is he looking at? And then I started looking around. Well, hell, they were topless.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it had anything to do with it. Mrs. A finally caught him, kind of scolded him a little bit. We all kind of laughed.
Mm-hmm.
That was interesting. The perspective that we got on that, too, was especially we were, these various leaders or guides or whatever you want to call them, they would lay all kinds of propaganda on us,
mm-hmm.
especially in Syria, about what happened at Quneitra, if I can pronounce that right,
mm-hmm.
and Golan Heights and that kind of stuff. So we're seeing and hearing all these stories from the Saudis or the Syrian side. And then later on, we're in Israel looking at the other side of Golan Heights
mm-hmm.
and hearing all of that dialogue from that tour guide over there.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was kind of interesting. Another impression I had, and I'm pretty much a pro-gun guy, that shouldn't surprise you,
mm-hmm.
but while we were in Jerusalem, there was some terrorists throwing grenades around.
Mm-hmm.
And very quickly, the shopkeepers pulled their guns out and shot him.
Mm-hmm.
They've all got guns in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way it is. That's survival there. And they didn't wait around for the army or police or anybody. They, of course, more than likely, some of the shooters were part-time army like everybody has to do anyway.
Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of an interesting situation where it'd be at stateside. People would be running around and eventually the cops would show up. Occasionally somebody shoots the bad guy before the cops get there, but not very often.
Mm-hmm.
But in that location, it's a totally different situation.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I shake my head about some gun-free zones you have here at stateside. What good is a gun-free zone? That's always what I kind of question. What good is that? Does that make you feel good or something?
Mm-hmm.
You think that's going to keep a bad guy from coming in here and shooting the hell out of everybody? No. So maybe you're thinking, if you have a concealed weapon, we don't really trust you, even though you have a permit. So maybe just for safety's sake, we won't allow you to be here.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only good a gun-free zone could possibly be.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, an enabler for the bad guy to come in here and just shoot the hell out of everybody.
Mm-hmm.
It's really what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So I personally, I don't really adhere much to those gun-free zones and mm-hmm. stuff. I don't flaunt or show guns or do anything like that, but I don't go very many places without a gun.
Mm-hmm.
I'm quite a ways from a gun here in the house, but I feel fairly secure
yeah.
here. You know, no, I'd have to run into another room.
Yeah.
You know? But I don't. That side note, I'm getting way off track mm-hmm. here. Do you want to hear some more about Middle East?
Well, the let's go to gun and Middle East. When the governor is given a gun as a present by the governor of Homs.
Yep.
And then he passes it to you to...
Well, naturally, again, I'm the guy that does things. You know,
right.
Changes the money, whatever it takes. So I had... Most of this you've heard, but you're going to hear it from my perspective. I had been told by the State Department in D.C. that we could put things in the diplomatic pouch and send mm-hmm. it back stateside.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't qualify it as papers. They said things.
Yeah.
So I boxed up this this pistol that this governor gave him, as well as a bunch of stuff that we had bought over there in the mm-hmm. souks or whatever, mm-hmm. some tin stuff and that they'd been hammering on, you know. I boxed that up and I sent a diplomatic pouch from the Syrian embassy, our embassy. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, as a side note, the acting ambassador told me that I couldn't do that. Mm-hmm. He said, that I won't allow that, he said. And I didn't pursue it because I'd already sent that stuff. Mm-hmm. It was already gone. He mm-hmm. didn't know I had done that. Mm-hmm. So why telling? You know, mm-hmm. I just left it alone. Mm-hmm. And that was the famous line where it ended up in D.C. And that guy calls Jerry, says, "Did you know there's a GUN in one of those packages that was sent?" Well, I'd put it there. That's how that had happened.
Yeah.
So they just UPS'd it back to the stateside. It was there when we got back to Capitol.
Yeah.
But that's really how that happened. One of the guys on that, one of the sponsors, I think it was, I don't remember what country, he asked if he could put a bunch of cigars in the pouch, Cuban cigars. Uh-huh. And I told him no, but I don't know if we had like the gun and some other stuff in there. I don't know if it made that much difference, but if I were to be asked again, I probably would have said, sure, what the hell, you know. Mm-hmm. I kind of regretted that, I guess, but these people had paid big money to go along on this trip, the Israel trip especially. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you should be somewhat grateful for that, I suppose, because they're paying for me, too, as well as the governor, and I think Pat Amadeo was on that portion of it, and Mrs. A was in Israel, too.
Yeah.
It's interesting, his staff was, the majority of those people were pretty much 100% Governor Attia. Mm-hmm. There was a few that were kind of looking out for themselves, too. I guess there always is around politicians.
Just, I'm in the middle of that portion of the book. Was Betty Modlin a 100% Attia person? She was brought on by Lee Johnson, but then she stayed for the whole time. Did you find her to be a 100%er, or was she...
No.
Okay. Because she was the assistant to Lee, then the assistant to Jerry, and that worked. But by the end, apparently, they had just really bad relations.
God, if you had asked me, I would have thought that Betty wasn't there the whole time, but she was, huh?
Yeah, she came over. She worked with Lee at the Department of Justice.
Okay.
And then came in.
And we're talking about Governor Johnson, too.
Yeah, exactly.
The
when did you come on? So he was already there, firm. Did you see tension from the beginning when you came on?
And I would have been there a little bit after 5 or 6 months.
Yeah, so you're there kind of the summerish of 79.
Yeah,
yeah,
and not too much. I mm-hmm. think it was driven home. I mentioned this car situation. Mm-hmm. We just had to get another car. Mm-hmm. And Betty heard me talking to somebody about another car. You know, I was negotiating with Ford or somebody, I don't remember now. Mm-hmm. And she told Lee Johnson that I was looking for another car for the governor. And Lee called me into his office and said, "Lon, you are not getting a car for the governor. He's going to have to make do with the one he has." So that answers your question. Mm-hmm. And she was pretty much Lee Johnson. That's what Betty was. Mm-hmm. And I just ignored him. You know, I didn't argue with him or take him on. I just ignored him. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure why I did that I felt that safe. Because at that juncture, I don't know that I was as firmly in position as, what's the word, ensconced or some darn thing, that that I could have been that brave. You know, I could have been history because I ignored Lee, but...
Yeah, because people like Pat Amadeo and Shirley Woodrow, Denny.
Jim, this is my wife, Karen.
Good to meet you.
Good to meet you.
Jim Moore, to be frank.
Did you bring your sleeping bag?
I did not.
With
do I need to?
With the amount of stories he has to tell, you may be here a while.
That's okay. I even have extra batteries.
Planned ahead, see?
Go in the other room, will
you? Yeah.
I already told him he couldn't look at you naked in the hallway there.
He wouldn't want to, believe me.
No, but those people, in effect, ignored Lee from the beginning because they'd been hired by the governor or even before Lee had come on.
But you know, even Pat Amadeo, I wouldn't say that she was 100% Governor Vick. She mm-hmm. was a liberal Democrat.
Yeah, yeah.
So, as it will, but I mean, not near the degree that the foundation for the governor, and I think he probably would have has said this too, would be Denny Miles, mm-hmm. Jerry Thompson, and Lon Holbrook.
Mm-hmm.
Those three people were literally his solid foundation for different reasons.
Yeah.
Denny being political and a jack of all trades, and same with Jerry, actually, both of those. And me, a lot less political, but more personal. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of how that went.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there were people like the schedulers, Susan Bibelheimer,
mm-hmm.
and... Early on, Glenna, mm-hmm. Glenna was a scheduler and kind of decided if the governor would, somebody could come see the governor sometimes and, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So those people were very supportive too, but not to the same degree, I guess. Susan Bibelheimer was just, she arranged for the trips. The departure from the governor, from Glenna, she resented, this is in my opinion, and, mm-hmm. and I liked on it, frankly, but mm-hmm. she had a lot of trouble with the campaign on the reelection.
Yeah.
And who ran the schedule and who did what, and she really dug her heels in there. And
so
that,
you saw that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Because there's a couple of stories that Denny tells, because he was running the campaign,
right.
that he never told the governor about why something had happened and it was going
up. Yep.
So.
And there's some stories he told me, and I was not to tell the governor if it was germane to something I need to know. And that oftentimes did happen. But, yeah, that was going on.
Okay.
And it's Carol, I think G was his... scheduler for the campaign, worked for Denny. And there was another time, and Denny's probably mentioned that, somehow or another, a photographer down in Springfield or mm-hmm. Sweet Home. Did he tell you that story?
Yeah.
Okay, well. Yeah.
The governor said, that was why probably, are we driving all over the place?
He was pissed off. And he was tired, too.
Yeah.
So that
that
kind of shook out. But
One last Middle East thing. Did you know that there was the no-negotiation pledge that Jerry had to sign before you went, that if the governor was kidnapped, that there would be no negotiations for his release?
I didn't know anything about that.
Okay.
Guess I didn't need to know, I guess.
Yeah. Well, nobody knew except Jerry. Denny didn't find out until well after the governor was out of office.
Well, I'm not surprised. The,
I guess, you know, that I guess that could happen in the foreign countries. God knows what they're thinking or what they're going to do, even in those days.
Well, you were, the real fear was Syria and Lebanon are tied at the hip. And Lebanon, that's when the hostages were happening and all sorts of
And he wanted to go to Lebanon in the worst way.
Yeah.
Because that's where his mother was from.
Yeah. Well, and Amar, you're almost there.
Yeah.
Right on the border.
But he finally consented that he wouldn't go there, but he really wanted to. Everybody in the world said, do not go to Lebanon. Yeah. Don't go there. But he wanted to. In a sense, I don't know whether it was gullible or reckless, but sometimes he, in his convictions, and Lebanon was a good example, and by God, I'm going to go there, you know, mm-hmm. kind of. He was a man of principle. There's no question of that.
Mm-hmm.
But again, his relationship with my relationship with him was, oh, whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally, I'd screw up, believe it or not, like the time that the governor had a like a state of the state speech, but I think on his second term,
mm-hmm.
he's now addressing all the department heads in Wilsonville. And like I told you, one of my many duties was his speech would be on the podium when he'd get up there to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And I put the wrong speech up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know it.
Mm-hmm.
And he started into his speech and he kind of stopped and he looked up at me and kind of frowned. And then he just winged it because he didn't have his speech there.
Mm-hmm.
He had the preliminary stuff that's pretty standard
mm-hmm.
at the time. But then when he got into the meat of his speech, he didn't have it.
Mm-hmm.
It was gone. And it was didn't really relate what he had in front of him to what he had to say. And he was, somebody there knew that the speech was the wrong speech or something. Jerry or somebody, I don't remember now. But he was a little irritated with me, but he just moved on.
Mm-hmm.
And to his credit, he just went ahead and made a great speech, winging it.
Yeah. It probably felt good to him, because one of the things when he moved from the legislature to running for office in 74, he really chafed at the fact that he had to write all the speeches. Because in the legislature, he'd get up and talk, and he was known not as a great orator, but he knew what he was talking about. He made cogent arguments.
Mm-hmm.
So it probably might have felt like going home.
And that was, again, overall, that was kind of his problem. He wanted to drive. That was one of the things.
Yeah.
He wanted to be in control. He had been all his life, and it was hard to have somebody else drive. It was hard
yeah.
for him. So he kind of taught me to drive in some sense like he wanted to drive. That was kind of a compromise.
Mm-hmm.
And he had said many times, a typical state cop really is a terrible driver when it comes right down to it, because cops are looking around at other people and violations and what's going
mm-hmm.
on, and they're not driving like
mm-hmm.
they should.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to get broke of that from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not very good at getting through traffic. They'll pull into a long line of cars where this other lane's got one or two cars.
Right.
What the hell are you doing over here, you know?
Right.
So I'd learned very early on to get through the traffic and move.
Yeah.
Not necessarily to be speeding in traffic, but to get through it anyway,
mm-hmm.
as fast as you can. So those are all things that played into what I had to do.
Right.
There was a couple of times, like one car almost hit us, and I swerved and missed him. But spilled hot coffee on the governor, and that was kind of a bummer. He didn't blame me for that, but
mm-hmm.
those things happen, I guess.
Yeah.
And the time that you talked about it, Eugene, more to that story, that one of the patrol officers in Eugene called us on the radio
mm-hmm.
and said, there's a term that state police, I don't know if they use it anymore, 12-3, inside. That means come to this office.
Mm-hmm.
No more discussion. Come to this office.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that to us, and I had them repeat what they just said. This
mm-hmm.
is not right.
Mm-hmm.
And they said it again. So we drove to that office. That's how we learned that there was something going on at the hotel,
mm-hmm.
at the Valley River or something or other,
yeah.
Springfield or some. No, it was Eugene, someplace there anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But so he'd just sit there and BS with whoever's working there at the office. He loved to do that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Except he was a little unhappy because he couldn't be on time to where he was supposed to be. The there were times when, again, that he was always BSing with the state policeman when he was supposed to be over here doing something else.
Mm-hmm.
But that there was even times when we'd be someplace and we just had downtime. There was just nothing. So he said, well, let's go over to the state police office over there. So there'd been more than once. We mm-hmm. literally walked into the office unannounced.
Mm-hmm.
And interesting reactions you get when you do that.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the governor. One of them was in Cottage Grove. And usually it was station commanders, if it was during the day, which mm-hmm. it usually was. So there'd be some lieutenant in there. And they ad-libbed pretty good, to their credit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some people would go, you know, here's the boss. But one guy in Cottage Grove, his wife had just had a baby. So he offered the governor a cigar and stuff. The governor, hey, this is great. You know, he sat around and bullshitted for a while.
Uh-huh.
And that was kind of interesting. Most people, that's a side that probably people don't really know about. But there was another one where down in that same area, pretty close to Eugene Airport, there was a train that hit a car or a motorhome or something. Mm-hmm. Governor said, let's go look at that mess. I said, Governor, there's some things there. I always called him Governor. That's mm-hmm. what I called him. There's probably some things you really don't want to see. Oh, I think it'll be all right. So he walked down a track a little ways and saw some blood and gore. He said, I see what you mean. Let's get out of here. Mm-hmm. You know, he believed me after just mm-hmm. seeing some of that.
Yeah.
This isn't the right side of things that one would want to see, he says. You know, yeah, you're right. Let's get out of here.
Yeah.
So we did. And the troopers at the scene, they're not going to run him off.
Oh, no.
If he wants to be there, he's there, you know.
Yeah.
They might say to me, God, you really want him here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, in fact, that happened on that one. But that was kind of interesting. Okay,
tell me about pulling people over.
That was really stupid. I should not have ever done that. And why I did, I'm not sure, but mostly because he wanted it done. But
did you have a siren you can put on the car?
I had a siren, had mm-hmm. lights and siren and mm-hmm. stuff. But it so easily that I'm out of the car dealing with this guy, and now what happens if there's a fight going on?
Mm-hmm.
You know, now the boss is going to get hurt, just sure as hell,
because mm-hmm.
he's going to get out and try to help.
Mm-hmm.
That's how stupid that was. We only did that maybe twice,
mm-hmm.
and usually I had another trooper with me, but I always regretted doing that. Why did I do that? And there was another time we followed a drunk to his house, and we drove by, and I'm sure that's the governor told that story a lot of times too. We drove by, we didn't drive in the driveway, but we turned around and came back. Big Saint Bernard is up with his paws on the door sill of the car, looking in the car, and the governor commented, yeah, that's man's best friend there, you know. And the trooper got in the driveway and talked. I think he arrested that guy. But that probably wasn't too bad. But we really shouldn't be doing any of that stuff. We followed a car that was speeding one time, and a drunk that was really mm-hmm. bad drunk, in and off, out of the median area, brush and mud would be flying. And we followed from a distance, kind of kept track of him. Finally got somebody in on the car. And I guess that's not quite as bad as stopping them anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Most of that stuff I didn't dare tell the superintendent about, because he would have really kicked my tail for it,
mm-hmm.
and rightfully so too. The one of the times I did get in a lot of trouble is Senator Mike Thorne was involved in that. And trying to think of the details. One of the troopers that were helping us in Pendleton told the story about Mike Thorne's daughter and boyfriend were seen at this drug house that they had staked out.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd seen her coming and going. And they said, it sure be nice that somebody tell Mike Thorne about that. And she was a beautiful girl. And turned out she worked for the state department head down there eventually, I guess. I don't know. But
she's like the head of the executive department now.
Is that where she is?
Yeah. She's head of the Department of Agriculture forever.
Well, after after that occurred, I got to thinking, okay, now how do we tell Mike Thorne about this?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the lieutenant in Pendleton, maybe or maybe not in conjunction with the superintendent, had decided not to say anything or get involved.
Right.
Now, this had all been adjudicated. It's not going to screw the criminal case up. But just politically, to be involved in any of that. So I told Mike Thorne what, just preliminarily, as to what happened, and suggested he go down to the patrol office and talk to the lieutenant there and get the story. And that's what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, he pulled, was that Katie? Was that her name?
Mm-hmm.
He pulled her out of school, I think, the school that she was going to. I mean, it was a major change in their relationship with their daughter. And that turned out well and good, but... And I still haven't said anything to the superintendent. What are you
mm-hmm.
going to say?
Mm-hmm.
So, later on now, the state police is in there. They're talking about budgets. And Mike Thorne was the chair of the Ways and Means or something.
Mm-hmm.
And if I've got that right. But anyway, John C. Williams was the superintendent at that time. And he was talking about having trouble with Mike Thorne and passing their budget. And the governor called the superintendent and me out into the hallway in that meeting and said to me in front of John C., did you tell him about what we did for Mike Thorne? And now it's all shit. Because now the superintendent's really pissed because I didn't tell him.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a communication problem there. Well, I couldn't tell him. Well, needless to say, the next day I was summoned to the public service building,
mm-hmm.
and I knew I was in trouble when the major and the captain that I worked for took me into this superintendent's office, and they sat way off to the side, so I knew I was in trouble then, and he chewed my ass out and said, mm-hmm. if I ever did that again, and that was the end of that thing,
mm-hmm.
thankfully, but that... could have been pretty nasty.
Yeah.
I don't know how else I could have handled that, though.
Yeah. Yeah, you would, in fact, have kind of two directions.
Right.
And what do you do?
And mm-hmm. Mike Thorne, quite frankly, was even though he was a Democrat, he was a friend of Governor Diaz.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, that's the beauty of those days. That those relationships that he had, even though he was another party,
mm-hmm.
that's a serious relationships in a trusting and professional way that they
mm-hmm.
they related, and that's pretty cool. I don't think there's as much of that goes on now.
No. There were. It's fascinating because when the governor was first in the legislature, he was always in the minority, but the Democrats would appoint Republicans as chairs of committees, and then Bob
if they deserved
Smith,
it.
Well, if they deserved it. I mean, nobody got anything unless they deserved it.
Right.
Bob Smith, not Budget Bob, but Congressman Bob.
Yep.
Becomes the Speaker of the House in 69, and that ends in the House. And within about 4 years, it ends in the Senate as well, where Atiyah is. So that partisanship comes in, but he's of that era. So he becomes governor, and he takes the party identification off of the applications. For any of the jobs. And he hires, you know, Bob Oliver.
For his staff?
For his staff and for all the state stuff that he controlled.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he took it off of there. Bob Oliver's a Democrat. Pat Amadeo's a Democrat. He hired who he wanted because he saw them as competent and those kinds of things. So it's just fascinating. Then Goldschmidt comes in and it's... you know, he does the dry rot thing, but it's just straight.
Yeah, there's Democrat. More rancor and anger and stuff
yeah.
going on there.
I just found a thing about Goldschmidt when he was the Secretary of Transportation back in D.C. he's called before the Senate because Goldschmidt has made it clear he's not going to release Department of Transportation money to people who oppose President Carter and are Democrats, who are like Jane Byrne, the mayor of Chicago. He said Chicago's not going to get any money because she doesn't support him. So he was doing that before and then brought it with him, and it just kind of stayed. So it's just fascinating to look at all this. So switch gears. Tell me about the Rajneeshis. What was different about your life? What was the same about your life as that whole thing unfurled?
First of all, it was a big concern of the governor's staff. And I don't know what percentage, but I took a lot of those calls from the old residents of Antelope and those mm-hmm. residents there.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have anybody to talk to. They were desperately looking for help.
Mm-hmm.
We're scared. We're scared for our lives. We're afraid of losing our house. We're afraid of everything.
Mm-hmm.
What can we do? Can you help us? And that was the kind of the discussions that, and what do I tell them? You know, we're trying to do the best we can. The governor is and his staff, but I can't give you anything more than that at this time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very awkward. So real downer. It was, after talking to some of those people, you're kind of, God, sure wish I could help them somehow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was going on for about, well, probably really heated up for a couple of months there,
mm-hmm.
maybe longer.
Mm-hmm.
There
was kind of a big, 1982 was a really bad year. And then it then came on again in 84 and 85.
I recall one of the, I don't think legally you could do that, but they had actually laid war plans with the National Guard.
Mm-hmm.
And they were actually setting up shop at Shanico, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's some legal problems there, but they kind of worked around that. But, you know, I don't know if they're going to run tanks in there, just what would happen. But
right.
there was some of that actual preliminary staging going on in Shanico by the National Guard and God knows who else. And that was in addition to the state police. That there at the end, there were like 20 detectives or something on in Rajneesh when it came apart.
Mm-hmm.
They were a little concerned about that. And then there was, at that time, he was a captain, I believe. Maybe he was a major, who I didn't get along with at all. I had a lot of problems with him later. But he was the kind of the commander of that area, and there was that kind of made it more interesting,
Pancrase?
Too. Pardon me?
Is this Pancrase?
No, Moyne was his
oh,
name.
Oh, Moyne. Okay. Yep.
And he was the same one that he was eligible to retire, and he was the one that was involved in a contractor building offices.
Mm-hmm.
And he accepted somehow or another some motorhome and some other things, all of which were felonies. And so he was gone, and he was
mm-hmm.
out of my life. That was a good shot, too.
Mm-hmm.
But that's nothing to do with the governor, but just kind of a side note. There's probably a ton of things as time wears on that I've forgotten or can't remember. One of the crazy things, it was almost funny, is one time Denny and the governor and I were motoring out in eastern Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And usually it's not near as pressing out there. There's not as many events you have
mm-hmm.
to go to when you're there.
Mm-hmm.
But we were motoring down the road, and there's a patrol car a ways behind us, not within sight, though, but there's a coyote running along the road there, and the governor said, I bet you can't get him. So I stopped and I shot at him, and I remember Denny plugging his ears
mm-hmm.
in the car, because there's a lot of, there could be a lot of noise in that car, and I said, in all seriousness, God, I missed him, and I have this pistol, you're not going to hit that coyote with a pistol, you know. But Denny and the governor were booing and hissing at me when I said that. We went on down the road. But that was kind of a I would have got in trouble for that if anybody mm-hmm. known too.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not hurting anybody, you know. But it's against yeah. It's against the law to discharge a weapon from the public highway.
Right.
So you really should ought not to do that.
Right.
Know?
Right.
But and actually, I took him squirrel hunting one time. Say hunting, squirrel shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Those little sage rats.
Mm-hmm.
They get in alfalfa especially, and they just create all kinds of hell. And those ranchers want them all dead, you mm-hmm. know. So I knew some people there in Condon. So after the parade, we loaded into a pickup, the three of us, this rancher and the governor and I. We went out to this ranch, and it was abandoned, but there were a lot of squirrels there.
Mm-hmm.
And the governor plinked away at the squirrels. That's not something you'd tell the news people either,
right.
You know. That'd be terrible. He's killing those squirrels.
Right. You know. Yeah, he could be in the musket competition in Southern Oregon, but not shooting squirrels.
Yeah, and I always thought, twice we went to Merlin, I think, they mm-hmm. had a deal there,
mm-hmm.
and they were shooting mortars, and they put bowling balls in these mortars. And we'd stand out there and watch that. Well, the finger holes and the thumb hole in the bowling ball, that would whistle
yeah.
when it was flying through the air.
Yeah.
And it'd shoot it out of this mortar, and you could... And I'd watch real seriously, because I'd want to know where it was coming down, you
yeah,
know?
Absolutely.
And I thought that was kind of interesting. He had a collection of those guns, those mm-hmm. old antique guns,
mm-hmm.
and he had, I don't know how many, but they were in this walk-in closet that he had, and he had little dowels so they wouldn't bang together.
Yeah.
And those were all arranged, and he liked to tinker with them and take them apart and fix mm-hmm. them and take the rust off of them, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
If he had time, he'd like to do that.
Yeah.
And, of course, you got built-in security there. That's what the hell. You can
right.
keep that's pretty valuable, all those rifles.
Yeah.
Like those kids and grandkids got all that stuff.
Yep. Yep.
But,
and I don't know. He said that was part of his therapy.
Yeah.
Cleaning guns, a little gun oil under his fingers, he felt better.
And he always was interested in what kind of gun I had.
Mm-hmm.
Because early on in his administration, everything was different. How should I say it? We didn't have, there weren't cell phones.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't talk on from the car.
Yeah.
And towards the end of his administration, there was a shared radio net that we had in the car. Anybody else that was on that same system could listen.
Mm-hmm.
It was shared system, like a party mm-hmm. line on a phone.
Yeah.
And there was some communication over that. It'd have to be pretty limited.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they weren't supposed to call him governor either when they talked to him on that phone. Not many people did. Mm-hmm. Jerry and Danny probably. But and the guns were different too. I had a revolver. It wasn't until towards maybe at the bitter end that I had anything but a revolver. Mm-hmm. That's just what we had.
Yeah.
A big heavy thing.
Yeah.
But eventually they of course went to whole different weapons. But there wouldn't be any really good way of communicating with the governor. It would have to be drastically different now with the cell phones, the computers and all that. Didn't have that stuff in those days.
Yeah, I just was reading, because that's also part of this, how the governor's office worked. There were codes, so like call on the radio, and if it was like code red, that means immediately get to a phone and call. And if it's code yellow, next time you stop, call, you know, that kind of thing. So,
it's similar to that. Of course, that was my responsibility. I was on mm-hmm. the receiving end of that.
Mm-hmm.
And the governor and I had all kinds of signals, and I remember vividly one time he was during the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
He was giving a speech in Portland, and Jerry, it was Jerry. She had to talk to him now.
Mm-hmm.
So now, she tells me this. So now I think I had pagers then.
Mm-hmm.
And she paged me, told me that she had to talk to him when I called her.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, he's giving a speech. He's right in the middle of it. She said, now, So now I'm standing in front of him in the audience, and I'm giving him the signal, you need to put your speech down and get over here, get on the phone. And he looks at me like, and I gave him the signal again. He says, so he made excuses and left the podium in the middle of his speech. It's pretty awkward to do that. And then he went over and talked to Jerry, and he did. He questioned me the first signal, but then he, because that's the relationship we had. And he said, that's the first time that's ever happened to me, I think. He said I had to quit in the middle of the speech. But then he went back. He handled it really well. He went back up, went back into his speech. And I think he told a little story to go along with that as to what happened. And the audience was appreciative of that. They laughed and stuff. And quite often, I think I told you my reaction or what I would tell him when he was having a bad day, but quite often he'd ask me how it went out from the audience, because I could kind of feel the audience and the undertones and what was going on. And again, it's usually just him and I there.
Yeah.
So if he didn't handle it, I handle it. You know, that was the end of that.
Yeah.
Occasionally, Denny or somebody else would be along, and all that part of it would be a lot easier if that was the case. But usually, it was my responsibility to get him the cigarettes or to tell him he had a crummy speech or whatever the hell it was.
Right.
So that was just the way the communication was in those days.
Yeah.
I got to thinking how radically different that would be now. In fact, Karen and I were talking. We just got back from Bend. We were watching our granddaughter in a tournament over there, and we got a new trailer, and we just landed back in here yesterday evening, and it was, I wanted to go to a concert that my granddaughter was in this afternoon, and it's a good time to talk to you too, so it all worked out pretty good, but we just got here, and I'm at 70 years of age, we better get out and do some things now because we don't have too many more years left to do that.
Exactly.
But that's the conversation we had had. We were coming back. God, how things have changed from communication-wise, how you can ask your phone where to go or where something is. I had none of those aids when I was trying to keep that schedule. I had to know and judge how long it took me to get from point A to point B.
Right.
And they wouldn't allow me to build in much cheat time there.
Yeah.
I just had to just flat. When Susan or Glenna, before that, when they'd come up with a schedule, they'd give it to me and say, okay, now what do you think? Can you keep this schedule? And also I had to have transportation on the ground to meet the planes.
Right.
Sometimes it'd be like three different planes or three different moves, and especially during a campaign. So I had to have state police there to grab us to get us to another spot. And so I kind of got the final approval on the schedule because I was the one that had to keep it. And I remember vividly the last day of campaigning, which was not the election day, is it? Is the day before? Whichever, but the last campaign day, we were supposed to fly into LeGrand. We couldn't get in there. It was too much snow and stuff. So we ended up in Pendleton, and I had put a hurried call in. I don't know how I even did that from the plane, but somehow or another I got, maybe before we, no? We had to divert from LeGrand anyway. We're going into Pendleton, and I told him to have a car there at the airport for us, the state police car. So I had some detectives. I ended up with some detective's car with, didn't even have studs on it. And that was the transportation to go back to LeGrand that night. So I've got street tires going over the Cabbage Hill and all of that into LeGrand, and we got there. God, some of the crazy stuff. So we crawled in and got like 3 hours, 4 hours sleep, and the governor is sitting in the lobby, and there's another state police guy that was going to come pick us up. And the reason, a lot of the reasons why we had state police if it wasn't me, it was another state cop driving, because we would have control over what was going on.
Right.
If you had some volunteer do that,
right,
some things happen.
Right.
Anyway, the ride shows up, and Governor was just exhausted. And he looked at me and he said, Lon, he said, I don't know if I can get up. And I said, Governor, you've made it this far. You're getting up. We're going clear to the bitter end. And he kind of chuckled again. And he was just kind of tongue-in-cheek. I don't know if I can get up, you know. But he chuckled, got up, got in the car, and we put the day in, to his credit. And as beat as I was, he had to be more tired, because there's more pressure on him than there was on me.
Yeah.
All these speeches and all these people, and
yeah.
I just had to worry about if he was okay, you know, and the transportation. But that was kind of how, just the look on his face, I don't know if I can make it through the day.
Yeah.
But I put it in perspective again, just like fornicate him and feed him dog food, you know, that just, that's the commoner's approach to, this is what we got to do.
Yeah.
So he appreciated that. He always did.
Yeah. In January 1985, so it's his last time when he's going to speak to the combined legislature, because it's the last session. He'll be out in 87. The night before that, he's giving a speech, and he gets deathly ill. Goes to the hospital. They don't know what it is. They pump him full of fluids. He gets up. He's able to give a speech the next day to the combined legislature. Denny... Jerry, to a certain extent, Dolores, think that it's an attack by the Rajneeshis. Because we're just beginning to find out about the possibility of the Rajneeshis poisoning food and stuff like that.
Yeah, they were putting stuff in the salads and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Did you respond differently after that, or... Did you mean when you got sick and
take you to the hospital?
Yeah, yeah.
No.
Did you look at it as...
No, I didn't. I didn't connect the dots up to that, possible Rajneeshi stuff. No. I just got him to the hospital and made sure there's somebody there that spent the night with him, make sure there was, you know, a trooper.
Yeah.
Some troopers had to hang around there.
Yeah.
But... there was nothing. I never connected up Rajneesh potential problems with that. I don't know. I can't remember if we did determine what was wrong with him.
No, they never did. But two interesting things off of it. I talked to Mike Sullivan, who was the DA out with the Rajneeshis, basically, and he definitely was poisoned. He almost died.
Yeah.
And when I told him that story, he said, "Wow, that's exactly what they did to me." Although he was in the hospital for days.
Where would they have got to his food to poison him?
Well, it's been described that the thing the night before, it was like a dinner, and then he was going to give a speech. And he got up to give a speech, and he just got white and felt awful. The worst he's ever felt, and off you guys went.
Could have been.
So.
No, I didn't know that.
The second part of it is... Barbara Roberts has been sworn in as the new Secretary of State just a few days earlier. And so she's at home, because, you know, it's Sunday night. Why would she not be home? Jerry called her and said, "You need to know that we took the governor to the hospital tonight." And Barbara Roberts doesn't remember what came after that, because, as she said, "I basically fell on the floor." Because she didn't, when you become Secretary of State, you don't think, "Oh, I'm the successor to the governor." I interviewed Barbara Roberts, and I hadn't put this together yet, but she was telling that. But the day I interviewed her was like 2 days after Kate Brown had become governor, when all of a sudden we were really conscious of what happens with the Secretary of State.
So, yeah. Yeah, that chain of command and all that.
Yeah.
No, I didn't. I was totally unaware of anything like that.
Okay.
The involvement that he had directly with the Rajneeshis, there were two occasions that I recall that actually they came to the Capitol building.
Right.
And I maybe should have geared up more for security than I did. I would have I think I had four troopers in the room with Governor and I. You know, how much battling can you do in a room like that? But I didn't frisk those guys. Sheila, when I say guys, Sheila was probably the worst of the lot.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't pat any of them down or do any of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if the governor would allow that. But I did have a lot of bodies there,
mm-hmm.
just in case. But mm-hmm. who knows, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't show any hostilities at those times.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we were at some events where there'd be red shirts that show up.
Mm-hmm.
So some of those events, hell, they could, and for that matter, they could have been non-red clothes at some event we wouldn't know about either.
Right.
Who knows? You know, right. It could have been plants. I know Jerry's husband at the time, Al Thompson, his, mm-hmm. I think it's his mother, threw in a whole bunch of money and...
Ex-wife.
Was that what it was?
Yeah.
She went aboard with the Rajneesh.
Yeah.
Well, hell, you know more a lot more about some of this stuff than I do, quite
well,
frankly.
Well, putting it together, I think that's going to be the thing about this book that jumps out at people. Because the state doesn't realize that the governor was doing a lot of stuff. Because
mm-hmm.
he didn't want to know.
No, that's not the way he's wired.
That's not the way he was wired. And, you know, you were talking about the calls from people in Antelope. You know, he was really torn. You know, the Rajneeshis have as many rights as you have.
Right.
And that's the right to have a gun. It's the right for freedom of religion. It's the right for all this stuff.
And they formed their own police department. They've got them the mayor and all that stuff.
Yeah. So he was torn.
Just as I was.
Yeah.
Probably more so.
Yeah.
Yep. Exactly. But at the same time, he knew there was some bad stuff going on there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So that was Al's ex-wife that was there.
Yeah. And apparently she's still involved with him.
Like you say, the guru jumps aboard the plane and gets the hell out of there, and Sheila goes her way, and everything breaks up. Now, all these people that have thrown in their life savings to this cause, you know, where are they at, you know?
Well, it turns out that in Australia and then in Europe, because the Rajneesh, the Bhagwan changed his name to Osho.
Yeah.
And so there are still Osho coffee places and Osho centers all over the place. And apparently Al's ex-wife is still involved in one in Portland.
In Portland?
Yeah.
So,
but it's just like a group of people, a little small group of people who come together and meditate and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's just,
so there's still little niches of those everywhere then,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah.
I'll be damned.
Yeah, but it just doesn't have the same hierarchy, and it crucially doesn't have Sheila.
Sure.
Who is trying to make it into something.
And do they have free sex and all that other stuff?
I don't know. To go to Australia and find out.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Now, did you ever go to Rajneesh Puram? Have you ever been there?
No, I haven't. I've been to Antelope, but I haven't gone out to the...
Interesting, some of the stuff they did there. And some of the stories about that, too, was the, you know, folklore and just like that poisoning
mm-hmm.
thought, you know, that may or may not have happened. Mm-hmm. Who knows? We know some people did, in fact, get poisoned and all mm-hmm. that. In fact, they had some convictions on that, if I remember
mm-hmm.
right. But the one story that we heard was one of the armored Mercedes that he'd take a joyride in, the guru,
mm-hmm.
hit a cement truck and came out better than the cement truck did in the crash. You ever hear that story? Yeah, we got that from the state police. And he, to the people's credit around there, they knew he was driving these Mercedes around, and nobody tried to kill him, to our knowledge.
Yeah.
I'm really surprised.
Yeah, Mike Sullivan tells a story because Madras is where the Bhagwan would get in his car every day and drive and then turn around there. And so there were a bunch of hecklers there where he was going to turn around.
Oh.
And the state trooper, I have the name somewhere, but whoever the state trooper was, push somebody out of the way just because there was a car coming through.
Yeah.
And so everybody's up in arms. They all end up in Mike Sullivan's office. He basically says, everybody shut up. And
they were pissed because his troopers helping the Bhagwan kind of thing.
They pissed because the Bhagwan thought that this trooper was pushing them out of the way. The townspeople thought that the trooper was helping the Bhagwan.
Yeah.
And they just, it just.
The hysteria was just big time at that time.
Yeah.
Some of it was rightfully so, too.
Mm-hmm.
God, if you think about it, they're loading all these homeless on buses and taking them over there. And
yeah.
What a mess.
Yeah.
And those are just what we know about all this stuff.
Yeah.
And never did find the guns either. They had all these guns, never did find those.
Yeah.
Don't know what the hell happened to them.
Yeah.
They drug the pond there and they prowled around in the hills, never found them.
Mm-hmm.
They had all these automatic weapons and all this stuff.
Yeah.
Don't know what the hell happened there. Yeah, I drove out there and looked at those structures. Yeah. Long after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
And it's incredible, some of that stuff. And all these waves of manufactured homes they'd moved in there.
Oh, yeah.
Mostly from someplace, Albany or someplace down there, that somebody made a lot of money on that deal.
Well, it said Monty Shelton sold all the cars to him.
The Mercedes?
The Rolls Royces.
Okay.
The Rolls Royces. But then he Monty Shelton would run out, and so the Bhagwan would buy Rolls Royces from Texas and places and have them driven out.
Right.
It's just wild. Jerry tells about in all of this, but pretty early on, and as it got tenser, she kept getting these phone calls from business people around the state saying, don't crack down on them. We're in a huge recession, and these are our only good customers. So that kind of political...
Besides, never mind the rights that people have anyway.
Yeah, yeah. It's just a wild thing. So I think that chapter is going to be the one that's going to really catch people's attention.
It's long enough ago where the average person on the street doesn't know what you're talking about.
No.
Talk about Rajneesh Puram.
No. In our archives, we have students who go through and catalog things and stuff, and none of them have ever heard of the Rajneeshis. Even if they're from out in that part of the world, they've never heard of them. And then they go through and their eyes get big.
I believe it. Absolutely.
We've got, among other things, state police would fly airplanes over to take pictures and see what was going on. So we've got all those snapshots. And there was an attempt outside of Antelope to build what they called a man camp, which would have taken Antelope, which had whatever, 80 people were in it. It would have had like 800 people in this man camp. And so they were doing things. You can still look at Google Earth and look down and see where the man camp was supposed to be. You can see the shapes.
Who was in this camp?
This is where they were going to... It was going to be for people who were true believers, but it seemed like... It never came through, but it seemed like as they continued to bring the homeless in... that they would have had put more of them there as well.
Okay.
But they were also having a problem because Rajneesh Puram was being challenged. Dave Frohnmayer said, you're not really a city.
Yeah.
And so they were beginning to move stuff over to Antelope because Antelope was a city. And they eventually took over the city council and the school board. And that's eventually, because of Dave Frohnmayer's ruling, the feds wouldn't let them get the database, the crime database.
Oh, ledge?
Yeah. Stuff. And so they said, okay, great, so we're now running Antelope, so we'll get it through there.
Yeah, because they had that Antelope police force there and all that.
Yeah.
Which scared the hell out of the poor old people that were still there.
Yeah, yeah.
Which were calling me and anybody else that listened to them.
Yeah. Yeah, Vern Duncan spent a lot of time there because the school district who runs it and the local said, well, we don't want our kids to go to a Rajneeshi school. So the Rajneeshis who run the school board have got to pay for our kids to be bused to wherever they would have gone, the next school district over, which, you know, is 40, 50 miles away. And so Vern is in the middle of all that stuff, and it's just wild.
Well, I thought, still, I thought it was incredible that the war camp they were setting up in Shanico to try to do something. And,
yeah.
And they worried about the 20-some-odd state cops that were inside that thing when it broke loose, too.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know what would happen to them.
Yeah.
Because we're talking a lot of people, you know.
Yeah, it's a lot of people.
And 20 state cops with the few pop guns they got in their pockets aren't going to be able to do much, you know. Mm-hmm. They're going to be history if they're not careful.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't have a lot to do with that other than just the calls and
mm-hmm.
the meetings that I would listen to and all of that. Mm-hmm. But you know.
Now, why would you get the calls? Would they just come into the governor's office and they just hand them to you?
Yeah. Somebody's got to listen to them.
Yeah.
Jerry would get calls, I'm sure, and Denny, a lot more calls than I got. But a lot of times, somebody has to do it.
Yeah.
Have Holbrook do it, you know.
Yeah.
That's kind of the way it was.
Yeah.
There was another time, there was a demonstration in Lloyd, I think it's Lloyd Marbette, if I got it right. He
mm-hmm.
had a thing about Wah-Chang in Albany.
Mm-hmm.
And he and a crew were up there demonstrating one day at the governor's office. And they had an over-modulated Geiger counter. And it set that on the receptionist's desk.
Mm-hmm.
They were just trying to get attention is what
yeah.
they're trying to do. And I put up that too much. I let it go too long. I shouldn't have. I had some additional people on the other side of the door behind the receptionist. They had to get through them to get to the governor.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I was there. But the receptionist finally called, and she said, I'm out here by myself. Do you suppose you could come out here and help me? So... And she was right,
mm-hmm.
leaving her as bait out there. So I went out there, stood by the desk, and I made him turn that Geiger counter off. Just making all that racket.
Mm-hmm.
I think I turned it off. I took
mm-hmm.
it away from him.
Mm-hmm.
And then I looked over my shoulder, and it looked to me like a guy was trying to go through the door. And it has a lock on it, electronic lock that I had installed for the receptionist to have to let you through that door.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought he was trying to get into where the governor was. So that was the end of that. Well, he was, trying to chain himself to the door handles, what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't realize that. But now Channel 6 is there filming right there.
Mm-hmm.
And I grabbed this guy, and I grabbed him by the head and neck and kind of hip threw him away from the door. And... he was going along with the program, but when you twist somebody's neck, the body usually follows along.
Mm-hmm.
If not, their spine is severed. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he hit against a, like, parallel of the ground. He hit against a, kind of a, one of these closet doors that don't have handles on
mm-hmm.
them. You push them,
mm-hmm.
and they pop open. He hit against that, and it really sounded bad. Crash! And he just kind of slithered down a wall. He didn't ask for that. He just wanted to get arrested. He
mm-hmm.
didn't want to get thrown against the wall.
Yeah.
And I thought I was going to get in trouble for that, too. Because I was the lead story on Channel 6 News.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were right there.
Yeah.
This guy, boom!
Yeah.
So, and nobody ever said a word to me.
Huh.
I never heard any more about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that usually the DA in those situations, they just dismiss the charges
yeah.
after a while. But I told them then, I said, okay, guys... if those of you who want to be arrested, hang around and I'll accommodate you. The rest of you, you have to leave. That's the way it is. And I think five or six of them stuck around. And they got hauled away, and that was the end of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought I was going to be in trouble for throwing that guy against the wall.
Yeah.
And the governor's inside the house, or inside his office, and he hit the wall so hard he could hear that out there,
mm-hmm.
that crash.
Mm-hmm.
And... That was one of the things that sometimes he'd get a little irritated because he liked to be in control, but when we're doing things and not telling him about it, he'd kind of say, you know, I am the governor here. I get to know these things,
right.
you know.
Right.
And there was a time that Jerry probably told the story at his house. And there were some more demonstrators there, and I don't remember what their cause was. And eventually, I think Jerry was there, actually, with the state cops and whoever else we had there, as well as I was, and they ended up arresting these people, which is all they wanted to do was get arrested anyway. But the governor called out and said, when are you going to tell me what's going on here? Because he was in the house. And I recall that. It's kind of, we had to remind ourselves, you got to tell him what's going on. You know, yeah. He is the governor.
Yeah, he didn't like surprises. Did not like surprises. Did he ever drive himself? I'm thinking specifically when Tom McCall died. Audrey called the governor, and he says that he got there as soon as he could.
Yes, occasionally he did. And that's the judgment call that I would have to make. You have to let him have some of his own privacy and his own life, especially knowing that he wanted to drive once in a while and stuff. So he would, I'd hear about it later, he'd go out, like he got a Christmas tree one year and tied it on top of the Lincoln or whatever car he had and came back and put the tree up. And I didn't know about that. It wasn't scheduled. The guards told me about it. I think they told me as he was driving away. But, you know, again, we don't have a lot of security around him. You got to make that judgment call. But there were times... there for 1 year or so, I was getting beat down so bad that I was having trouble staying awake. So there were two or three different times when I just couldn't drive anymore. And I'd ask, usually we were coming home from a long day, and I'd say to the governor, do you think you can drive? I've had it. So... He drove two or three different times like that, and he actually enjoyed it. I think, oh good, I get to drive for a change, you know. And I couldn't; I was done for. And eventually, I got another full-time person to help me. And again, they said, well, he's just going to stay over in headquarters. You're going to call him once in a while. Well, there were times like Mrs. Atiyah. I remember one time she had to go to Sandy to make a speech. Coming back late at night, you know, you don't want to send her up there by herself. So we had a state police radio put in her Mercedes, an older Mercedes, for those occasions. She'd like to take that car up there. And so I'd have usually Daryl, this guy that helped me quite a bit, he would drive her up to that event. And rightfully so, you know, she shouldn't go up there by herself. It's either that or a governor's staff takes her up there, you know. But again, I really felt kind of bad for her. Not unlike my wife, she was like kind of almost divorced. She didn't have it. Didn't have a husband. Really.
She just when you drove them home after his term was over, she was just so excited to get home.
She was?
Yeah.
Well, he always talked about that was a big, big issue for him to watch us drive away from his house when we dropped him off. That really hit home. He talked about that all the time. Just realized I'm not the governor anymore. There goes my car. There goes my state cop. And so on
but
and so forth.
But then he could have the license plate he wanted. Ex-gov.
And there wasn't anybody telling me he couldn't have that plate.
Exactly.
Mainly me. Okay, what other track you want me to go down?
I think you've covered a lot of tracks.
There were things that, you know, like that fornicate them and feed them dog food. That wasn't anything that anybody knew about, you know, that just, that was between him and I.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. Did you ever see him really angry?
Yeah. He was angry that time that you talked about when we backtracked that picture there. He was angry then. There were a couple of different times. I don't remember what the causes were. But him showing anger is not like maybe me showing anger. You know, you just... If you didn't really know him, you might not even know he was angry. But occasionally he would be put off. I think there was one time he was kind of angry with Lee, too.
Mm-hmm.
Probably more than once. But, again, when you're talking about Lee, I didn't really know him real well.
Mm-hmm.
The governor, that is, with Lee, that, I don't know what that slop over was, but it was like, what, a couple of years at the most? A year?
Yeah, it was, well, 78, he's hired in December, and he's out in September of 81. So it's basically the first two legislative sessions. And there was an active move to get rid of him. I haven't pegged it down, but it's like late 80, early 81. Lee Johnson, for instance, was up to head the BPA for, and that didn't work. And announced in the summer that he was leaving. All through negotiations, basically through Jack Faust, who was his good friend, and the governor said, "Can he get Lee to leave?"
So they were. He was kind of the intermittent. He was in between in that situation?
Yeah, yeah. It's fascinating because the governor, I mean, he hired people who he thought were good and competent. But his first choice to be chief of staff...
was not a good one.
Well, but he wanted either Lynn Newbery or Jerry.
Yeah.
He told me in 2014 twice that it was Jerry. He told that he did a thing with the Oregon Historical Society in the early 90s. He told them it was Lynn Newbery. But whatever it was, those were his first two choices. And Lee wasn't even on the list.
Yeah.
And so it's not, that's a total mystery as to how Lee bubbled up there. Denny has hypotheses, but there's no verification of them, so I'm not going to use them. But
Denny may be the smartest person I've ever known.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say that right off the top.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned a lot from Denny. Especially in the political world,
mm-hmm.
and all of that kind of stuff, but practically too, he pretty damn smart.
Mm-hmm. And he was learning a lot then too. I mean, he was a young guy who, as he freely admits, was probably in over his head when he started, and he began to put things together, and you know, work. How do you work with that big of a staff?
And really?
He did all sorts of just really...
Not unlike me, actually. I probably was in over my head when I started doing that, mm-hmm. stuff. I didn't know anything about politics or, mm-hmm. any of that stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it is just on the fly.
Yeah.
And a lot of it was with Denny's help, too.
Mm-hmm.
Denny was really pushed hard to get a state cop to help the governor, a full-time regular person.
Mm-hmm.
He probably more than anyone by far said, "You got to have somebody that's part of our team doing this. Mm-hmm. This is crazy."
Mm-hmm.
And the governor fought him a long time on that. It didn't help any with the first state cop that he had, but kind of had a problem.
Mm-hmm.
That really kind of hurt it too.
Yeah.
But just for the common sense of just getting from point A to point B is what you have to do. He needed somebody that, not a stranger, somebody that's part of the team.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And that's what Denny pushed for, pushed really hard.
Yeah.
And finally the governor gave in. But there's no question of the loyalty of Denny and Jerry. You
mm-hmm.
know, 100 and, you know, you hear people say 110%, but how do you do more than 100%,
mm-hmm.
you know? But those two, very much so, were unequivocally head and shoulders loyal to the governor.
Yeah.
No question about
yeah.
it. And they were both really fun to be around.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine.
All the time. I remember there was times when we had, they even broke out a bottle of brandy or something at the Signy died at one of the sessions. I don't remember all of what was going mm-hmm. on, but everybody had a drink or something. I don't think the governor did, but Jerry and mm-hmm. Denny did.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I ever saw the governor drink anything besides some sake. Is that how you pronounce
mm-hmm.
it? Just because that's part of the ceremony or part of the deal.
Right.
I think that's the only time I ever saw him drink anything.
Yeah.
The only vice he had was smoking nearly for quite a while there.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
And he was as exactly the way that you would look at him and think that he was. That was him. There was nothing false about him. Mm-hmm. He's as solid and as honest as could have been.
Yeah.
When he died, irony of it was, my part-time job is a photo radar van, even though I'm 70 years old, but mm-hmm. it pays good, and mm-hmm. it's just a part-time job. And I can, if I don't want to work for 6 months, I can tell them that, and that's a great job.
Mm-hmm.
But I hadn't been working that particular night, and Suzanne called me. She said, the governor's in the hospital, and he's not very good. She said, we're up here at St. Vincent's. So I just parked the van and got my car and drove over there. I was pretty close in Beaverton. Mm-hmm. And he was in a coma, so to speak. But he could he reacted a little bit when you talked to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. I squeezed his hand and he reacted. So that was good for me.
Yeah.
And his brother and Dolores, his brother's wife, those three were in the room. And then I came out of that room after I was just in there for a little while. And Mrs. A recognized and knew me too when I went in there. And she was been kind of slipping too at that time.
Yeah.
But she knew me, hook, line, and sinker. But I walked out of there, and Tom and Suzanne, who now have to make decisions,
mm-hmm.
they asked me, well, what do you think? And I said, let's go in the room in here. And I said, quite frankly, he would not want to be like he is right now.
Mm-hmm.
You got to let him go.
Mm-hmm.
He's lost control, and he does not want to be in this situation. And Suzanne was the one that was kind of digging her heels in.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, yep. We agree. You're right. So then they told the doctors right after that that I kind of pushed him over the edge, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And they respected that. So they told the doctors, just let's unplug him and let's go from there. I don't think he lived very long after that.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of, I don't know, a couple hours or whatever it was. But that was a pretty hard time, too, really. But those memories of him and his staff, and not just Denny and Jerry, that there's some other really great people and relationships that I had with those people, especially Susan Bibelheimer that I worked very closely with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was pretty special, really was.
Mm-hmm.
And the dedication of those people, how hard they worked, pretty cool, really.
Yeah.
And some of the stuff that would go on, they'd start talking about, and occasionally there were things that affected the state police.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't go across the street and tell the state police.
Yeah.
That's going to stay here, and that's the way it is.
Yeah.
And a lot of, I don't think anybody in the state police realized that kind of stuff goes on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're being police, you know.
Yeah.
I'm sure they didn't realize that there were times they were talking about the state police. I'm sitting there too, and hell, I can't tell them. I can't tell anybody, really.
Mm-hmm.
I just move on. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that confidence, so that's pretty important. If anybody had a sense that I'd run across the street and tell a story of what I just heard, that's going to be the trouble.
Oh, yeah.
But nobody ever questioned that, because I didn't. I wouldn't even consider it. But there were times when it'd sure be nice to tell the state police that this was coming down the pipe at them, you know. This kind of hits you where it hurts.
Right.
But you couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And there a lot of times I'd walk into a room, and I think I mentioned this before, but nobody ever tried to boot me out of there or anything, mm-hmm. but the governor always would look around, not always, but usually he'd wonder, why is he here now? You know, you can just see his face.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as I'm not giving him any signals, he'd just move on, mm-hmm. you know. Well, whatever.
mm-hmm.
He was like a second father to me, really.
Mm-hmm.
Gets right down to it.
Yeah.
I think about, we talked about the communication, or the lack of, how easy it is now to ask your phone where something is or how to spell something.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
We didn't have any of those things then. God, that would have been a lot nicer. But at the same time, there would have been people bugging the governor all the time if you had that stuff.
Yeah.
And there were times he'd sit over there in the seat and write his speech on the way to wherever we were going. He'd put the speech together over there.
Yeah.
And I marveled at that. How in the hell can you do that? You know? But he did.
Mm-hmm. It was a learned skill from those campaigns.
I'd get car sick trying to do that sometimes, yeah. that he would do. It occurred to me, you know, I'm just like other people. The hard line into our house.
Right. You said when you call, I called you on the hard line.
And usually I don't answer that.
Yeah.
Yep. It's usually some salesman want me to buy something.
Yeah.
But I was going to hit on, there was something else too that...
Him working in the car, thinking about speeches.
Yeah. God. Hell to get old and forget shit. I think I forgot stuff even when I wasn't old, though. Oh, there was one time towards the end of his administration where they were roasting the governor.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it was towards the end because of the superintendent at the time. Whoever was putting it on wanted me to be one of the roasters.
Mm-hmm.
So now Dave Frohnmayer, Norma Paulus,
mm-hmm.
a couple other big wigs, and mm-hmm. Lon Holbrook
mm-hmm.
were going to be the roasters. Well, who do you think that they were looking forward to doing the roasting the most? It was right. me. Because I had inside stories.
Right.
And I really didn't say that many. Jim Sellers, the speechwriter, helped me a little bit. But
mm-hmm.
mostly I just told some stories. But they really thought that was funny. But the superintendent of the state police was nervous as hell about that. about his state cop over there roasting the governor,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was all in good taste. And I didn't say or do anything that would make him mad. I knew better than that.
Mm-hmm.
One of the stories I told was the old joke about the bureaucrat shows up at this ranch or farm, whatever it was, and says that I have this card and I'm an important person and I'm going to go over here and I'm going to fish or do some damn thing, however you want to tailor the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I can do it because I'm a bureaucrat. Here's my card.
Right.
And I kind of molded that into the governor doing that. And pretty soon the bull is chasing him. And he yells out, mm-hmm. help me, help me. And the rancher said, show him your card. And that's the way that story goes.
Mm-hmm.
You've heard variations
mm-hmm.
of that several times, I'm sure. But they like that story because
mm-hmm.
I plugged the governor in as the bureaucrat.
Right.
That was kind of fun. And some similar stories too, but he didn't get very mad when he or get upset that he showed it a lot,
mm-hmm.
but occasionally he would.
Mm-hmm.
But and usually part of my role was if there's somebody creating a problem. If they won't let go of him or, you know, they're close to him and
mm-hmm.
won't, he can't separate from him. My role was to take care of that.
Yeah.
And I would occasionally step on somebody's instep or do something to distract them from him to me,
mm-hmm.
and he could then get away.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my other major roles was to tell him that he has to, it's time to move. We have to leave.
Right.
Because he can't do that. I mean, they get upset. Now, I'm shouldering that blame because I'm now taking him away from their important thing, whatever it is. And they're not happy about that. So they, in a sense, kind of get unhappy with me. And that's okay,
mm-hmm.
as long as it isn't the governor.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the role that I would have to take.
Yeah.
And he knew that he had to move when I'm telling him to move. He probably knew before that. I'm not telling him, but I'm suggesting that he needs mm-hmm. to move. And he also understood that it's just something you have to do.
Yeah.
And people would get irritated with me. That's the way life was. But that was one of the many things that I've had to do.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody, at no time did Denny or anybody set me down and tell me, this is my role, or this is what you do,
mm-hmm.
or don't do.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like you just said, like Denny maybe early on, you just learned on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
Figure it out, you know. Mm-hmm. And it didn't have anything to do with being a state cop, mm-hmm. really. It just figure it out and try to get through to the whatever you have to do at the time.
Yeah.
Sometimes being a state cop helped, though, when you when you're dealing with people like in like hostile situations, like in Portland, for instance, if you have a crowd of people and some agitators in there creating trouble, people are watching. Mm-hmm. Very intently they're watching.
Mm-hmm.
So how you do that, you get real close to them where they can't see what you're doing. And you talk to them about their mother wears combat boots or whatever you're going to say.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you pinch them or do something,
mm-hmm.
but not anything obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And you get them to swing at you.
Mm-hmm.
And now this crowd of people, well, they understand that. They understand why you just arrested them, but they mm-hmm. didn't see you pinch him or anything.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of how that works.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that same story, that would happen, not a lot, but occasionally with me. And usually they're not getting arrested. They just are now diverted away from the
mm-hmm.
governor.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't pinch very many people, but I did step on the instep of their feet occasionally.
Yeah.
That happened.
Yep.
Another funny thing is a lot of times, Denny's a pretty good-sized guy, and they would mistake him for the security and me for the aide or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of fun to watch that. There was also this story about we were in Medford, and there wasn't any place to eat in this banquet room. It was packed.
Mm-hmm.
People really loved their governor in Medford and Roseburg and Baker City, and
mm-hmm.
much more so than Portland,
mm-hmm.
believe, big time. Anyway, we were at Medford, and I'd already sent two state troopers down to a coffee shop down the hallway to get some lunch, and I stayed there at the banquet.
Mm-hmm.
And Denny came out and said, there's no place to sit in there. He said, where did the troopers go? And I said, they're down there in a coffee shop. He said, well, where are they at? It's a pretty big coffee shop. And I said, just go in the door and look along the wall. They're sitting there someplace. He looked at me, and he went down there. And later on, he said to me, how did you know where they were sitting? You didn't go down there. And I said, they're state cops. They're sitting with their back to the wall someplace. That's what they do.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he said, I never thought about that. But he really wondered how I knew where they were.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's just the way it is. That's just one of the nuances of being a cop. You don't sit out in the middle of the room where you can't see what's going on.
Yeah.
Even to this day, my wife gives me trouble for, I pretty much know the people that are around us where we're sitting
mm-hmm.
and things about those people. I'm watching them.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what that's a learned trait or just what causes that, but I've always been that way ever mm-hmm. since I've worked for police. I think that's just a cop thing, frankly.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
If something starts going south, you know, those traits are real helpful when you're trying to take care of the governor, too.
Mm-hmm.
You're kind of watching people. And not necessarily obviously, but, you know, just kind of looking around and making note of what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the governor would ask me about something or some person later on, and I'd usually know because I'd been mm-hmm. looking at them. But at no time did anybody ever sit down and say, Holbrook, you need to do this and this and this. Occasionally somebody would say, need you to help do this. But at the same time, I had to temper that with what the governor would allow me to do.
Right.
And he's so darn independent and so, not bullheaded, but stubborn, I guess. Mm-hmm. Some of those things, maybe early on, he was hesitant to let happen. Then eventually he realized, well, it would be easier if Holbrook did that. If he takes care of the small stuff, I can take care of the big stuff.
Right.
And that relationship kind of blossomed as time went on.
Yeah.
Because I didn't start out taking the speeches up and put in speeches at the podium for him and doing all those other little things. I didn't start that way.
Mm-hmm.
We started by, I showed up to the office. He'd come out, hand me the keys, and we'd go down and get in the car, and he'd tell me where we had to go.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything evolved kind of from there.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't, he really didn't want to be a bother. He didn't want a lot of state cops, instead of being police officers, trying to take care of him. He didn't want that mm-hmm. going on. That's mm-hmm. just the way he was.
Mm-hmm.
As time went on, he kind of relented and realized some of that had to occur. So that's kind of a evolution, if you will, from him. But he was always, even to the bitter end, he would always be over talking to some trooper that I had there instead of doing what he's supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
Always they were doing that. And he would, you could shake him free from that, but he still would do it.
Right. Were you there the day that Williams and Miller brought him in a uniform?
Yes.
I have the pictures of that.
Yeah.
He finally got to be the commander-in-chief.
Yeah. And that paddle was that big, big thing.
Oh, yeah.
Up the creek without a paddle.
Yeah.
I don't know where that is now.
It's actually on display at the university.
Oh, okay.
And actually talking to Tom Attia a couple of years ago, the person that came from when it was down on a, you know, a trip on the Rogue River.
On the Rogue.
He was saying, when am I ever going to get my paddle back? We got it. It's in our archives. And it's on display right now, actually.
Really?
Yep.
Was that one of the Boises or something? Was that where the paddle came from?
I'm not sure. I haven't traced down exactly that particular.
You know, there was a old sheriff, Boyce was his name,
mm-hmm.
and they had some of those jet boats and stuff there at mm-hmm. Gold Beach or wherever it was, and he was notorious for giving hitchhikers haircuts and stuff. I don't know if you've ever heard any of those stories, but mm-hmm. they'd pick, those are the days illegal to hitchhike.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the deputies would, they'd come into their county, and they'd actually haul them into jail. They'd arrest them for hitchhiking, and they'd get a bath and a haircut. That was all part of the deal. Mm-hmm. So their hippie hair, they didn't have yeah. anymore. It got yeah. cut off.
Yeah.
That went on for quite a while. Sometime in that process, two deputies at Pistol River got in a famous shootout with two guys at this cabin and killed both of them.
Mm-hmm.
And there was all kinds of stories about that, too. That's, you know, and what's going on in Grants Pass having nothing to do with the governor now, but there's no sheriffs, deputy sheriffs there at all yeah. in Josephine County. And that's an interesting thing that's going on there. And I don't... The only law they have at all, I guess there's one or two road deputies now, is state police. And there's not a lot of state police there to help no. them either.
I mean, they took out that the state police place at the intersection of I-5 years ago.
Yeah.
So there's not, they're probably all out of Medford or something. It's just nuts.
And somehow or another, they've gone all this time, and they still don't have any sheriff's deputies
yep.
there.
Yep.
And how do they're taking care of themselves. They have these all these vigilante things going on, and
mm-hmm.
and it's interesting.
this last election in May, they finally, the county people, finally voted a little bit of money to not shut down the jail.
That's a mandated service. They have to have
the jail. you can shrink it like everything else.
Which is what they did.
But they finally said, okay, so here's $3 million over 2 years or something.
You can have a jail.
For the jail for other stuff.
Limited.
Yeah.
But a jail.
Yeah. Yeah. It's nuts. One last question. Been doing this for a long time now. Did you see anything with the governor and the tribes?
Relationship?
Relationships. Stopping in at Warm Springs on the way to other places, you know, anything like that, or anything that jumps out at you?
Well, he was very, very close to Warm Springs, and he cherished going over there every year to the Piamshaw days. Mm-hmm. That was,
It's right about now.
And, yeah, and he, he looked forward to going down to Whiskey Dick, I think it was called, at Fishing Hole, where they went.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a story there that's a good story. He two stories, actually. One of the days we were down there, he'd just go down and fish for one day, usually. He'd go to their Piamshaw celebration and do a parade and do all that. But he was there with the tribal chiefs. And while he'd fish over there at the Big Eddy, they'd come in with these trucks and they'd have a kind of a big feeding of those that were there.
Mm-hmm.
And it'd be the attorneys, from Bend that represented them. And they were usually some or all of them would be there.
Mm-hmm.
And they would be fly fishing, mostly fly fishing. Although I remember one of the tribal members was using a treble hook or something, but they can do whatever they want on their side of that river. And there was one year where the governor was down there fishing, throwing his fly out there, having a great time, and a boatload of attorneys came floating over there, and they had all liquored up, and they were giving him shit about, hey, white man, you can't be over here fishing. This is tribal area.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they knew who he was.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the tribal police guys, and that's a whole different breed of cat, I'll tell you. He's sitting up behind the governor, and he's got bandoliers on. And I think he had some darkened stuff under his eyes in a M16, fully automatic. And he comes up and levels a 16 at these guys and says, you guys better get the hell out of here. They dug water and got out of there really quick, and I just sat there laughing, you know. That'll teach them.
Uh-huh.
At the same time, there was one year, maybe the same year, here comes a patrol car driving in there, and once again it was Jerry had to talk to him, and he wasn't about to be bothered with anything about work. He was there fishing with the Warm Springs, the thing he liked to do.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent me up to deal with whatever it was. So I had to drive out someplace and use a phone. He called her. She said, he won't come out, will he? He said, no. He's dug in, Jerry. It's the way it is. She said, well, tell him this, and we need a decision. So I went back down, got his decision, came back, called her again, and that was pretty much the end of that.
Mm-hmm.
But that happened occasionally. But not very often do you have a patrol car. Probably shouldn't have been on that road either exactly. With that car. Drive in there to try to get the governor's attention. I don't know how they even found him, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a normal place to be. There was another time at the lodge at Kaneda. He was in an upstairs room. And I think I had a room next to him in a... One of the other tribal police had a room on the other side of him. And they were pretty proud of their governor and that Warm Springs bunch. And there were some kids underneath us having a kegger of some kind. And Cliff Jenkins was that policeman's name. He went down there and said, you guys got to knock it off. There's nothing. You guys, no more noise, nothing. And they said, okay. So then they cranked up again. They were making noise. He went down there and took their keg away from them and kicked them out of the place. They said, "You can't do that." They said, "This, we have our rights." He said, "You don't understand where you're at. You're on a reservation here, buddy. You guys are out of here." Mm-hmm. So they booted him out. Thought that was interesting. And there was another time, he was like the assistant chief. He was one of the cliquas. We were there for a Mason indoctrination kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And part of that, they do some top secret thing that only Masons can see when they're initiating their new members. And they came out and announced to me and this cliqua, this tribal assistant chief, I think is what he was. They said, "Well, you guys can't go in there. This is Mason's only thing. This is real serious stuff." And Klika said, "Maybe you don't understand. You're on the reservation. I go where I want to go. You can't tell me that I can't go in there." And he went in there and watched that ceremony. I didn't. But I thought that was this Mason telling this Klika that he couldn't go someplace. I'm thinking to myself, that ain't going to work.
Yeah.
They are in their own countries, in essence, what they are.
Yeah.
And they got to understand that. That's what's happening here.
Yeah.
As well as the dumb boatload of attorneys telling the governor he couldn't fish there.
Mm-hmm.
That was almost hilarious. But, you know, I'd leave him there. Again, that's a judgment call of giving him his own privacy.
Mm-hmm.
I'd take him over there, and I think Smith was his name. One of his supporters was an attorney. He'd pick him up and take him into one of those private fishing clubs, and that was the Deschutes mm-hmm. River, too.
Mm-hmm.
And it was behind Lock Gate and everything mm-hmm. else. They'd take him in there, and he'd stay there for, usually it's one night. He'd fish for a couple days. And there'd be state police cadets that would come down the river, and after the first year he did that, they knew I'd alert him as to when he'd be there, and so he'd always be able to talk to them and stuff mm-hmm. as they come through there, and that was kind of interesting. And occasionally there'd be a regular state cop in one of those rafts coming down there too. But
mm-hmm.
but I just left him there, and he was on his own. You know, I could have pressed it and said, "I've got to be there, Governor," but I couldn't really justify that in that case. You know, nobody knew he was there, especially. You know, what the hell? Let it go.
Yeah.
And that's just part of the relationship with him. Just make that judgment as to whether to distance yourself. Now, I don't know what the team does. Now, there's five or six state police teams as a result of that Secret Service survey mm-hmm. that are with him now. And there's not all the time, but there's people that have days off. And
mm-hmm.
and the Secret Service said you got to have at least two cars.
Mm-hmm.
You got to have your lead car not the client, but whoever you're protecting. So there's two cars involved in your motorcade, mm-hmm. at least two.
Mm-hmm.
And that you asked me about MAD. There was a time when he was riding with, I think it was President Reagan,
mm-hmm.
and he was in his motorcade. And we went up there and we put him in the motorcade, and I stayed with him. He got into the president's limo with the president, and I think I got in the car behind him
mm-hmm.
with all these Secret Service guys and everything. And and I asked the state police captain that was at the end of the motorcade to let the governor's car in there, because when that motorcade goes through, screws up traffic.
Yeah.
If the governor's car is in that mess behind, it's going to be lost for a while.
Yeah.
Well, the captain just ignored me and wouldn't let the car in. I didn't know that had happened. And the governor stood around for about half an hour waiting for his car, and he was not a happy camper that mm-hmm. time. And that was something that I was kind of shouldered some of the blame, but I sure got that captain in trouble for that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, there was another... in fact, that President Reagan was coming in like 2 weeks later into Portland. And the first time we tried to drive to the Benson Hotel, and the Portland Police and Secret Service stopped us about three blocks from the Benson or wherever he was staying, the president, and said we couldn't drive to the hotel because the governor's car had been secured, quote, so you can't drive up there. So he had to get out and walk through the rain to go to this hotel where the president was. He wasn't real happy about that, and I was probably less happy about it. And while I was there the first time, I noticed they were securing the cars at the hotel where they told us we couldn't go. They were wanting and doing everything under the cars. So the second visit, I went to the